social acts out of desperation or for other clear reasons. Poor judgment and failure to learn from experience. Pathologic egocentricity and incapacity for love. Poverty in major affective emotional reactions. Interpersonal unresponsiveness. Impersonal, trivial sex life. And failure to follow any life plan. Batman's foes broadly demonstrate most of these qualities. Some, like the Joker, show signs of them all. A person could have many of these qualities without having them all. Snakes in suits, when psychopaths go to work, laid out core deficits that might produce psychopaths who are not physically aggressive. Some fail and get imprisoned for white-collar crimes, while others successfully avoid criminal sanction yet cause interpersonal problems for everyone who works around them. Lay folk in the media bandy the term psychopath about so commonly in connection with serial killers and other clear-cut fiends that people popularly overestimate the criminality, severity, and sheer twistedness of most psychopaths. The person with no conscience, no empathy anywhere in his or her soul, might or might not take an interest in violence or sadistic cruelty. Consider the stockbroker who misappropriates millions, gutting retirement funds and fleecing so many who entrust their savings to him, indifferent to lives wrecked along the way and even resentful toward those darn complainers. Prognosis. Do psychopaths get better? Diagnosis involves naming a person's condition, identifying what's wrong, whether that means determining physical ailments like measles and malaria, mental illnesses like PTSD and major depression, or personality issues and disorders that not everyone considers to be mental illnesses. A prognosis is a forecast. The clinician's estimate, best guess, about a condition's probable course, duration, and eventual outcome. Prognosis for psychopathy and various personality disorders is poor. Criminals without ingrained personality problems, such as psychopathy and APD, are more likely to reform. No medication can make a psychopath grow a conscience, and they do not respond well to therapy. Doctors typically prescribe medication to those with antisocial personality disorder only when they exhibit comorbid conditions, any additional disorders they also happen to have, like addiction or depression. Although psychopaths usually do not exhibit mental disorders either mild or severe, so therapists often don't even have that much to work on. Psychopaths lack insight, drive, and incentive to change. Because they aren't disturbed by their behavior, they are rarely genuinely motivated to change, which makes any real collaboration between therapist and patient unlikely. In fact, some forms of therapy seem to make them worse by allowing them to hone their skills at manipulating others. Treatment for antisocial non-psychopaths nets better results by fostering impulse control, teaching them to recognize triggers that set off their problematic behaviors, and helping them improve problem-solving skills. Cognitive skills training seeks to modify how an offender thinks, targeting problem-solving and perspective-taking skills, while cognitive restructuring works on what the criminals think, specific values, attitudes, not blaming others, ways to minimize harm. Antisocial personality disorder, the diagnosis that focuses on antisocial actions, does not often appear in old age. Age-related reductions in impulsivity, social deviance, and antisocial behavior do not prove time has warmed up antisocial individuals' cold hearts. Older psychopaths, while exhibiting fewer of the impulsive antisocial actions that might get them arrested or diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder, nevertheless remain frequently selfish, callous, deficitful, manipulative, and deficient in empathy toward others. Losing the ability to stir up as much mayhem as they may have in younger days does not necessarily turn them into warm, caring human beings. Meet Joe Chill. Which kind of crook killed the Waynes? We don't know much about their killer, the mugger Joe Chill. Much as we might like to demonize the man whose sins launched a billionaire vigilante's war on crime, he seems to be a small-time thug who panics when Thomas Wayne stands up for Martha, and then she screams. The few stories that depict confrontations between Chill and the grown Batman show him to have become a career criminal, maybe becoming a hard-nosed mob hitman, or maybe a mid-level crime boss whom Batman terrifies. Either way, antisocial personality disorder seems likely. The hitman version, while seeming more coldly psychopathic than the terrified crime boss incarnation, comes across as more human and more interested in other people than many of Batman's foes. Earthy Joe Chill would seem out of place in a gathering of Batman's flamboyant, most malevolent foes. Neither does he belong among the lunatics crazy enough or idiots dumb enough to take jobs as supervillains' henchmen. Batman may spend more time taking down everyday criminals reminiscent of Chill, but he more famously fights freaks, among whom the distinctions between the different evil disorders matter little, because most of them fit the whole lot. Case File 6-1. Bane. Real name, unknown. First appearance, Batman, Vengeance of Bane, number 1, January 1993. Origin. A corrupt court system imprisons a woman in a hellish South American prison, Peñadura, for the crimes of her lover, a revolutionary who evades capture. After she dies, their son has to serve out their sentence in that prison where he was born. He grows up among killers and madmen. He plays with the rats. Bane, this child of two fierce warriors, learns from hardened criminals and a visiting Jesuit priest, whose books provide the boy a classical education and whose gifts of toys give him some solace, especially his teddy bear Osito, which the boy considers his only friend. A hole in Osito's back conceals a knife that Bane uses against those who bully him. Bruce Wayne, at age 8, sees his parents murdered. Bane, at 8, commits his first murder. Bane pushes himself to become harder, stronger, deadlier every day, to do more than survive there. He means to thrive. Killing dozens of other inmates along the way, Bane establishes himself as king of the convicts. An experimental drug called Venom, expected to kill him like previous test subjects, instead gives him monstrous strength. He engineers a jailbreak and heads for Gotham City, attracted by the challenge of beating Gotham's Dark Knight. After exhausting Batman by freeing all of Arkham Asylum's villains, Bane attacks him at Wayne Manor and breaks the hero's back, earning Bane his reputation as the man who broke the bat, and forcing a recuperating Bruce to enlist a hero called Azrael to take his place temporarily as Gotham's guardian.
I've known you since I lived in the hell of a dark hole thousands of miles from here. I've known you in my dreams, and I escaped from that hell, escaped from my dreams, for one reason only, to find you and to break you.
Bane to Batman in Batman number 496, July 1993. Bane is to Batman what a juggernaut called Doomsday is to Superman. A brand new big bad who comes out of nowhere, causes chaos all around, and then delivers the hero his greatest defeat. Bane's drive to beat Batman for the sheer sake of beating Batman illustrates his strong achievement motivation, need for achievement. The need to overcome obstacles, to attain a lofty standard, and to rival and surpass others. Biochemist Henry Murray, who turned toward a career in psychology after psychiatrist Carl Jung guided him through his personal dilemmas, identified a variety of needs that motivate and direct human behavior. Not everyone has every need. Over the course of a lifetime, a person might or might not experience them all. Needs can influence particular individuals so regularly that the possession of a consistent need becomes part of those individuals' personalities. Following up on this, psychologist David McClelland asserted that three dominant needs comprise human motivation: need for achievement, NACH, need for power, NPOW, and need for affiliation, NAFFIL. A person could feel driven toward achievements unrelated to power and affiliation. Bane yearns for power too, but belittles affiliation. It is the nature of plans involving others. They are flawed because humans are flawed. I will miss the antics of my foolish associates, especially the girl. But I cannot be Bane with them attached to me. The authorities think they have won. But my plan left no room for error. Either I conquer my enemy, or I was set free of all encumbrances, even the girl. It was caring, it was emotion that made me weak. And now I am free of it, as I planned all along. Bane in Secret 6, number 36, October 2011. He understands strength in numbers and can enjoy a few people's company. But as he lacks incentive to maintain that enjoyment, he demonstrates low need for affiliation, the need to belong with others. Those who value affiliation most, requiring approval and interpersonal connection, make good team members but poor leaders. Reflecting on his few tentative attachments makes Bane decide they put him at risk because enemies could use those bonds against him. So he parts ways with a group called the Secret Six. Subsidiation refers to situations in which one need activates to satisfy another. Bane's need for power, secondary to his need for achievement, supplements that greater motivation. Power helps him achieve. Personal power, power over himself, he believes helps him attain power over others. The everyday management of any criminal organization would leave him dissatisfied if that power posed insufficient challenge. He weans himself off venom, a source of physical might, when he decides addiction to venom would be weakness. And yet he risks addiction again at times when the venom offers him an advantage in pursuing a valued goal. It doesn't matter who we are. What matters is our plan. No one cared who I was until I put on the mask. Bane, Tom Hardy, in The Dark Knight Rises, 2012 motion picture. Chapter 7. The Halloween Party. Why all the costumed crooks? After the arrival of its costumed hero, Gotham City sees a proliferation of costumed characters, most of them criminals whose theatrics and preoccupations rival the Dark Knight's. Does Batman inspire their histrionics no less than he inspires new heroes? Does he attract creative crooks to Gotham? Or does Gotham itself create them all, vigilantes and villains? These villains are not simply out to steal. They seek excitement, they need challenges, and they want attention. Quietly stealing a fortune and getting away with it won't feed their other needs. On top of the psychopathy and antisocial personality disorder that the previous chapter covered, the most famous felons in Batman's rogues gallery show extreme behaviors that transcend those of everyday criminals. Serial crime. A serial criminal, e.g. serial killer, rapist, or arsonist, commits a series of three or more crimes of a specific type with a cooling down time, a varying interval of weeks, months, or more, between separate law-breaking incidents. Some seek attention, others do not. How does a serial criminal differ from any other repeat offender? The lack of ulterior purpose plays a role. Whether a hired assassin like Batman's enemy Deadshot kills cold-bloodedly or gains personal satisfaction from the act, the main thing that contract killer gets from each specific kill is a fee or other clear external benefit. A terrorist kills and destroys in order to instill terror and advance an agenda, however sensible or insensible that agenda may be, as the Joker does throughout the 2008 motion picture, The Dark Knight. The serial murderer kills for killing's sake, satisfying an emotional drive. Gotham's nihilistic serial killer, Victor Zsasz, who cuts hundreds of tally marks on his body, one for each person he claims to have murdered, keeps himself from feeling depressed about the meaninglessness of life by liberating others from the burden of breathing. So why don't we say serial vandal? Why don't we call a kleptomaniac who repeatedly steals for thrills and then loses interest in the stolen items a serial shoplifter? As popularly used, the serial terminology clearly denotes heinous violation of the rights of others. A criminal on a crime spree commits the crime at three or more locations over the course of hours or days without cooling down. In 1958, 19-year-old Charles Starkweather and his 14-year-old girlfriend, Carol Ann Fugate, murdered 10 people, including Fugate's parents, during their 8-day killing spree across Nebraska. Spree murders, swift nature, and the frequency with which these killers end up dead make this phenomenon already hard to understand, even harder to study. Few criminals get to go on more than one crime spree, much less an entire series of repeated sprees in real life. Gotham's criminals combine elements of series and spree with a bit of mass murder mixed in, as befits comic book series' need for recurring villains and Bill Finger's classic formula of pitting Batman against each foe 3 times per story. First, Batman loses. Next time's a draw. And finally, Batman wins. Whereas serial murder includes breaks over time and spree murder involves changing locations, mass murder involves killing 3 or more people in the same location without cooling off in between. Several of Batman's enemies, not just the Joker, have slain entire families. Batman's enemies range in the degree to which their crimes are instrumental in nature. They do steal for money. They kill, extort, and give fish clown faces thinking to make money. There are better ways to make money, more effective methods that draw less of the authorities' attention. Arguably the most instrumentally driven bat foes are the eco-terrorists Ra's al Ghul and Poison Ivy, both out to protect nature from humankind. Both think globally. Ra's, more so than Ivy, who can also be content for a time with the flora of an island or local park. Personality disorders. The criminal nature of Batman's foes seems so deep-seated in most of them that they often appear to have personality disorders. Your personality is your characteristic pattern of behavior, your set of dispositions and tendencies to act and feel certain ways. Characteristic, in that, it characterizes you. It distinguishes you from other people. Pattern, and that it refers to your qualities that have greater consistency over time. And behavior, broadly meaning both overt actions and covert mental processes like thoughts, feelings, attitudes, and beliefs. Someone with a personality disorder has difficulties so deeply ingrained in who she or he is as a human being that the central problem defines that person. This is not something that comes and goes simply based on circumstances. Medication, which may alleviate some resultant difficulties like depression over life's complications, cannot cure the core problem. A pill does not give you a personality. People with personality disorders have never been enough like other people to grasp fully the depths of their own problems and how very different they are from everyone else. Rather than recognizing themselves as the true source of their own unhappiness, if they're unhappy, they can mope, feel unhappy about how life isn't working out like they desire, and get frustrated when everybody else fails to arrange the world to suit their tastes. They lack the insight and motivation needed to change. Personality disorders are also known as trait disorders, because the person's essential problems are their own traits, not simply transitory shifts in mood or coping ability like PTSD and major depression. Clinicians do not diagnose children with personality disorders because, for one thing, no matter how clearly some people under 18 appear to be developing personality disorders, a few will surprise everyone and mature into healthier human beings. Symptoms do show up early. The most callous antisocial adult would have been a cruel child. In some cases, knowing a person's childhood experiences may shed light on a personality disorder's origins. A lot of Batman's foes face ostracism in childhood. The Penguin for both physical and social oddity, the Riddler for being a smarty pants. Experiences that can lead to withdrawal, anxiety, resentment, paranoia, or aggression. though why one child in such a situation develops one way and a different child grows another remains a bit of a mystery. The person with antisocial personality disorder isn't the only one short on empathy. The four most dramatic or volatile personality disorders, grouped together as the DSM's Cluster B personality disorders, antisocial, see Chapter 6, borderline, Chapter 2, narcissistic, and histrionic, all show psychopathic qualities. Lack of empathy, a pervasive pattern of grandiosity, an inflated sense of importance, and a need for admiration, all figure into narcissistic personality disorder, that is, super egotistical disorder. They know they're great. They possess excessive aspirations for their own lives and intense resentment for others whom they perceive as more successful, beautiful, or brilliant. They are preoccupied with and driven to achieve their own goals and think nothing of exploiting others in order to do so. Despite their show of grand self-importance, they are often troubled by self-doubt. Relationships with others, whether social, occupational, or romantic, are often distorted by the perception of others as tools for self-gratification. Noting differences among narcissists, some personality psychologists proposed subtypes: amorous, sexually preoccupied and seductive while avoiding intimacy; elitist, upwardly mobile, flaunting accomplishments and status; and unprincipled, lacking standards for acceptable behavior. Any of these can exploit others in different ways for different reasons. The unprincipled narcissist shows antisocial tendencies. Unscrupulous, unremorseful, and untruthful, this arrogant individual, when caught breaking laws, blames victims for the fact that the narcissist got caught. A narcissist breaking laws and violating others' rights often enough can also qualify for antisocial personality disorder. A person can qualify for more than one personality disorder. Nobody follows a cookbook when developing a personality, healthy or otherwise. These disorders are labels professionals made up to simplify the act of studying, discussing, and trying to predict patterns of behavior observed in different individuals. The penguin is quite elitist. In most depictions, he has been a pot-bellied man, odd-looking with a beak-like nose, shorter than average, but not abnormally so, and never with flipper hands until Tim Burton turned him into a circus freak for the film Batman Returns. Since then, depictions have gone back and forth in whether he's funny-looking or freakish, his manner becoming more compensatory than in earlier days. He compensates for his short stance and horrible appearance with an active sense of panache. He is constantly seeking attention to his small self, exhibiting histrionic personality tendencies as well as narcissistic tendencies. The defining quality of histrionic personality disorder is constant attention-seeking behavior. This drama llama far exceeds the normal human need for attention. Histrionic essentially means theatrical, melodramatic. Many people who try too hard to get attention don't qualify for this disorder because that yearning does not fully rule their lives. The histrionic person does whatever it takes to be the center of attention at any time. They make great shows of emotion, like wailing at the funeral of people to whom they weren't particularly attached, only to switch readily to another expression if it gets more reaction. Those emotional displays are fleeting and shallow. Unlike the narcissist, even the compensatory narcissist, the histrionic person feels altogether inadequate and unworthy. While the narcissist expects to be the center of everyone's world, the histrionic person does not expect attention and therefore frantically, perpetually strives to get it. Some histrionic individuals habitually tell lies, a symptom called mythomania, compulsively lying even when honesty seems advantageous, because the truth makes them uncomfortable. Lies protect them. If you don't like the histrionic person's lie, he or she doesn't have to take that dislike personally, because it's not about anything real. Whereas a scowl at something truthful could hurt deeply. Even those histrionic persons who don't lie all the time exaggerate, inflate, and tell every story theatrically, They so desperately want you to find them interesting, it's ironic that they fail to follow the number one rule for getting others to find you interesting. You must show interest in them. Batman's enemies may sometimes seem more narcissistic than histrionic at heart, but their outlandish antics scream for attention. As the Penguin once put it, "Where's the thrill in committing the perfect crime if nobody knows it was you?" With few exceptions, Batman's enemies know what they are doing. They know who they hurt, and they know it's wrong. For some of them, that's what makes it fun. Roman Sionis, the first Gotham crime lord to call himself Black Mask, not to be confused with the second Black Mask, Dr. Jeremiah Arkham, who suffers psychotic episodes with hallucinations and delusions, applies cutthroat business practices in his efforts to take control of the underworld. When Batman finally captures him, Sionis goes to Blackgate Penitentiary, not Arkham Asylum. Until, of course, his inevitable escape. The man likes torture. When he tortures Stephanie Brown, a.k.a. Spoiler, trying to extract information about Batman, this would seem to be an instrumental act driven by extrinsic motivation. Drive to do one thing to achieve something else. Because he is putatively torturing her in order to achieve another purpose. When he tortures Catwoman's sister Maggie and brother-in-law, kills the brother-in-law, and forces Maggie to eat her husband's eyes, this is an expressive act driven by intrinsic motivation, an expression of his own feelings, something he enjoys. This degree of torture serves no clear purpose. Catwoman doesn't even know about the eyes until after she has already surrendered to Black Mask. Cruelty so deeply ingrained in Sionis's personality might indicate sadistic personality disorder, if his craving to hurt others, physically or psychologically, permeates most aspects of his life. Not to be confused with sexual sadism, in which the person hurts others specifically to achieve a sexual thrill. More likely, he is a sadistic psychopath, demeaning and aggressive, with no conscience, but not always ruled by his sadism, however extreme it may be. Personality disorders may be less permanent than clinicians have traditionally thought. The previous chapter pointed out that the elderly exhibit lower rates of antisocial personality disorder. In fact, all the Cluster B personality disorders become less prevalent in old age. They have traditionally been viewed as disorders of immaturity, consistent with the relative rarity in the geriatric population of either the prototypical manipulative, self-injurious borderline woman or the criminally sociopathic man. It is possible that these individuals suffer personality retardation, a developmental delay by which their personalities mature more slowly than other individuals, thereby taking decades longer to learn to care about people, to become more comfortable with others and themselves, to establish more stable traits, or even to grow a conscience. The maturation hypothesis proposes that many individuals with Cluster B personality disorders become better able to manage their behaviors over the course of their lives. Then again, because these individuals are more prone to engage in dangerous activities, recklessness can get them killed. Threats, manipulation, and violence can push others into fighting back. Police kill more of them, as do other criminals, would-be victims, and good Samaritans coming to someone else's defense. Attention-seeking behavior might include suicide attempts that inadvertently succeed. Narcissistic or histrionic individuals feeling frustrated or underappreciated may choose to say goodbye to this cruel world that won't show them enough attention. Alternately, the lower prevalence among the elderly may be an illusion created by weariness with life or reduced ability to act out the rotten things they'd love to do if only they still could. Sensation seeking. Some do it for thrills. Sensation seeking, the need for varied, novel, and complex sensations and experiences, and the willingness to take physical and social risks for the sake of such experiences, has emerged as one explanatory construct for the length to which some people will go in their pursuit of excitement. Why do some engage in legal, socially accepted kicks and adventures, non-impulsive, socialized sensation-seeking, while others might abuse drugs, break laws, gamble out of control, and endanger themselves or others. Impulsive, unsocialized sensation-seeking. People are complicated. While Batman is not impulsive, his social acceptability remains arguable, and those norm-violating, law-breaking villains aren't all so impulsive. Some are quite meticulous, even patient, in forming their plans. Jet pilots, e.g. Batman's Justice League colleague Hal Jordan, a.k.a. Green Lantern, skydivers, firefighters, riot control police officers, and race car drivers score high on sensation, but in different ways from drug addicts, juvenile delinquents, and other criminals. Psychologist Marvin Zuckerman identified four major components to this variable. 1. Thrill and adventure seeking, physical activities involving danger, speed. 2. Experience seeking, novelty, e.g. travel, art, nonconformist lifestyle. 3. Disinhibition, seeking release through uninhibited social activities like wild parties or methods of identity concealment like wearing a mask. And 4. Boredom susceptibility, restless discontent and aversion to repetition and routine. These qualities overlap with the impulsive, antisocial, or unstable lifestyle seen among many psychopaths, but are separate issues from psychopathy's callous, egocentric, unremorseful side. Batman's flamboyant, thrill-seeking foes have both those sub-factors covered well, as when the Joker both impulsively and remorselessly shoves a henchman into ongoing traffic for not laughing, or hurls girlfriend Harley Quinn out a window without bothering to see if she survives. Sensation-seeking men score higher on thrill and adventure-seeking, disinhibition, and boredom susceptibility. Sensation-seeking women score higher in experience-seeking, in general, not universally. A sensation-seeker himself, Zuckerman's reflections on his own life take us back to the question of whether people with these ingrained traits really outgrow them. In his college days, he reached my full sensation-seeking potential through drinking, sex, and hitchhiking around the country, and had imagined that upon retirement, he would spend his days hang gliding, parachute jumping, and doing many more adventurous things. Toward age 74, the need for physical adventure declined, but the need for new experience never changed. In the comics, the original Batwoman eventually trades in her costumed nightlife for the thrills of running her own circus. The Golden Age Batman retires from administering justice with his fists to take on procedural challenges by becoming Police Commissioner Bruce Wayne, and marital challenges by becoming husband to the Catwoman of Earth 2. His life still revolving around crime and at least one criminal, still pursuing his passions even as he changes his methods of doing so. Obsession. Obsessions, persistent ideas, thoughts, impulses, or images that are experienced as intrusive and inappropriate, and that cause marked anxiety or distress, abound in the lives of Batman and his foes, e.g., how he dwells on his parents' deaths, or how his enemies obsess over him. Unlike many obsessed individuals, these characters give in to their preoccupations, rarely attempting to ignore, suppress, or otherwise neutralize those recurring thoughts or resultant compulsions, clearly excessive, repetitive actions, or even mental rituals like counting that the person feels compelled to perform, and experiencing discomfort whenever circumstances force them to resist. Because the preoccupations are technically obsessions only if experienced as intrusive and inappropriate, most of these characters are not actually obsessed. Because these time-consuming themes and habits do not distress most of these characters, who live without interest in resisting, few of them will ever qualify as having obsessive-compulsive disorder, OCD. The DSM specifies that adults with OCD, by definition, have at some point recognized that the obsessions or compulsions are excessive or unreasonable. Though insight into the unreasonableness of the obsessions and compulsions ranges widely. OCD is an anxiety disorder. The obsessions and compulsions, one way or another, bother the sufferer. Some obsessive compulsives are uncertain. Others know fully what's wrong. Insight can vary across times and situations, such as when a person sees a problem for what it is while discussing it with a therapist, but sets all that insight aside outside the therapist's office. Through most of the Riddler's history, he relishes the challenge of creating puzzling crimes, freely sending riddles that give Batman and the police clues to those crimes, even though giving such clues might help the crime fighters foil and capture him. But sometimes he tries not to send those clues. Sometimes he resists. He's saner than many of Gotham's ghouls. Celebrities of crime. Like common criminals, Gotham's costumed crooks indulge themselves, satisfying their whims, desires, obsessions, and compulsions at the expense of others. Unlike everyday repeat offenders, however, they transform themselves into surreal entities, dangerous celebrities who transform the world itself into their playground, and its people into toys, over and over again. To a great extent, they're living the dreams that starry-eyed individuals like the disturbed young man who shot President Reagan in hopes of turning himself into a celebrity spin through their heads. In masks, makeup, tally marks, and more, they enrobe themselves in nightmares in order to transcend mundane reality and enter a world of living legends at any cost. Most of them, who know exactly what they're doing, are no less sane in their world than professional singers Madonna, Lady Gaga, or Kiss, who recreate themselves into spectacular stage personas to become different generation stars. Elvis Presley gyrated in sequins and cape before Las Vegas crowds. Carmen Miranda wore a bowl of fruit on her head. And the Riddler wears question marks wherever he stages his show. Case File 7-1. The Riddler. Real name, Edward Eddie Nygma, N-I-G-M-A. Nygma, N-Y-G-M-A, Batman Forever, or Nashton. Comics go back and forth on which is his birth name, which is an alias, and which is a misspelling. First appearance. Detective Comics number 140, October 1948. Origin. Unlike the Joker, Penguin, and Two-Face, the Riddler has no abnormal physical qualities and can walk freely through a crowd. He has no particularly dramatic origin story. Obsessive-compulsive disorders usually don't. Gifted with great deductive ability, he grows up as a child who loves solving puzzles. Finding ways to cheat others is a kind of puzzle he likes. Instead of punishing young Eddie when he discovers the boy has been stealing from Dad's pockets, his father begins hiding money in increasingly creative locations. "He wanted to see exactly how far I would go. Said if I was going to be such a stubborn little thief, I was going to have to earn it." As a child, his love for brain teasers was exceeded only by his overwhelming desire to win at any cost, which over time creates a problem that feeds itself. He enjoys solving and creating puzzles. Too few people are bright enough to keep the task of creating puzzles challenging for him, and yet his need to win won't let him enjoy seeing his creations get solved. "Life's full of questions, isn't it, Batman? Though naturally I prefer to think of them as riddles." Riddler in Batman number 452, August 1990. At one point, Nygma recovers memories of how his father's abuse drove him to his convoluted truthfulness. But extensive empirical investigations by psychologist Elizabeth Loftus and others suggest that we need to be wary of trusting memory, much less recovered memories, emotion-laden memories, or Freud's view of repression itself. Yes, the abuse may have occurred. Then again, Eddie's unhealthy mind and the circumstances under which the memories come to him could easily conjure a pseudo-memory, a bogus remembrance that makes a dream, daydream, suggestion, fantasy, or dread seem vividly real. The Riddler first appears as a sideshow carny who cheats customers with rigged puzzles and games. Aching for greater thrills, he heads to Gotham and dons a costume specifically so he can challenge Batman, whom he sees as a potentially worthy adversary. Gotham's caped crusader and costumed crooks directly inspire this man to become an arch-criminal. Riddler. "First,
I must call Commissioner Gordon, and then confound him with a little riddle.
Girlfriend.
Oh, why take time for that?
Riddler.
Crime is no fun without riddles.
I'll have you know that's the main reason I took up this crime game.
He loves the limelight. Attention feeds him. His riddles and death traps, while ostentatious in nature, aren't just about seeking attention, or he wouldn't create traps that always have a way out. There's a kind of honesty in everything the Riddler does. He'd rather tell the truth creatively than lie outright. Hence, the riddles. The attention he could get by killing Batman or by outing his enemy as Bruce Wayne pales in comparison to his love of the riddle itself. Having deduced Batman's secret identity, the Riddler taunts him with possible exposure until Batman calls his bluff. Riddles are your compulsion, your addiction, and a riddle that everyone knows the answer to is worthless. However much he sometimes wants to commit a crime without sending a riddle, when the caper itself already challenges him, he cannot. When he tries to commit a series of robberies without telegraphing his plans to Batman via his trademark riddles, he subconsciously leaves clues anyway. His attempts at fighting the compulsion show that he recognizes it's not healthy.
"You don't understand," he says after one failure. "I really didn't want to leave you any clues. I really planned never to go back to Arkham. But I left you a clue anyway. So I have to go back there. Because I might need help. I might actually be crazy."
Irresistible impulse, although part of some legal standards for insanity, by itself is generally insufficient as a legal defense. Otherwise, kleptomaniacs and addicts of many kinds would be unconvictable. Addictive behaviors continue long after they stop being fun, because failing to act on them stresses the addict, pushing that person to seek release from the internal pressure. Physician Rakul K. Parikh diagnoses the Riddler with obsessive-compulsive disorder, OCD, which is not a psychotic disorder. The Riddler knows his obsessions and compulsions originate from within himself, not from anybody else beaming them into his head. DSM criteria for OCD specify that at some point during the course of the disorder, the person has recognized that the obsessions or compulsions are excessive or unreasonable. So the Riddler's doubt and fear that these symptoms mean he's psychotic actually suggest that he is not. Riddler.
You dimwits think I create my riddles because I want to be caught. What naive pedestrian thinking.
To me, crime is performance art. And that's what you psychobabblers share with the rest of the world. Lack of vision. The Riddler has gone through spells without the overwhelming need to commit riddling robberies. Retaining his interest in puzzles and crimes during the lengthiest of his OCD remissions, after emerging from a coma, missing many memories, including his knowledge of Batman's identity, he becomes a private detective, solving crimes out of self-interest. For stipends, rewards, publicity, and sometimes to clear his name when crimes look like his. Even without his compulsion to create conundrums, he's a self-centered jerk. His lack of empathy and regret still indicates psychopathy. Without a hint of remorse, he ignores a plea to help a friend in danger because a good mystery occupies his thoughts. His relationships are shallow. Despite showing features of both psychopathy and narcissistic personality disorder, with his massive ego, he is no sadist. He's not the most malicious of Batman's enemies, and so he does not easily fit the severe antisocial narcissistic blend that Eric Frome first called malignant narcissism. He is not the quintessence of evil. People interest the Riddler. He doesn't seriously care about specific individuals, but he wants attention and enjoys adoration. He's attracted to women, and often has one at his side during a crime spree. Except for a pair of biker women who become henchwomen called Query and Echo, we rarely see any of these girls more than once, and he'll abandon those two when leaving them behind helps him cover his escape from Batman. Romantically, he shows interest in women, though only while they're new and unknown. When they lose their mystery, they lose their appeal. He wasn't in love with her. He was in love with the riddle.
Unsettled when a bomb goes off in his face, Eddie grows disillusioned with clean living. Old impulses start nagging once again. When Edward Nigma's OCD rears its head, he plans crimes. Lacking any strong connection to non-criminals, he has no one to ground him, no reason beyond self-interest to stay out of crime. His return to crime is confirmed when he shows up with a spunky teenaged partner he calls his daughter, Enigma. If she is his daughter and they maintain a relationship, that one thing could help him become less full of himself. While some narcissistic individuals put themselves even before their own children, some other narcissists can adore their children as extensions of themselves, which then teaches some of them to care and think outside themselves. Father and daughter bond by ambushing Batman. Periodically, writers who miss either the point or the value of this character send him down the mirth, mayhem, and murder route. These attempts to make him edgier never stick. And then later writers who want to write real Riddler stories chalk the previous aberrations up to insanity, mind control, or demonic possession. This kind of cognitively driven robber, motivated by intellectual and artistic challenge, simply does not have a multiple murderer's background, motivation, personality, or sadistic passion.
I am nothing like the Joker. Why does everybody keep saying that? That clown is only interested in mirth, mayhem, and murder. I, on the other hand, live for mental challenges, games of wit, the chance to outsmart worthy opponents.
Riddler in Harley Quinn number 6, October 2001. Case file 7-2. The Penguin. Real name, Oswald Chesterfield Cobblepot. First appearance, Detective Comics number 58, December 1941. Origin. Teased and bullied by other children who nicknamed him Penguin for his squat body and beak-like nose, lonely little Oswald Cobblepot turns to his mother's pet birds, calling them my only friends, because they wouldn't judge or reject him. He wants human friends. He wants a girlfriend. Strange-looking and socially awkward, he never fits in, a misfit mocked at school and in his family's wealthy circle. His overbearing and overprotective mother, convinced he might catch pneumonia and die like his father, makes him carry an umbrella everywhere he goes. When she too dies, or in a later version becomes invalid, leaving behind debts that send their holdings into foreclosure, he loses everything he has ever clung to for security, the person, the prosperity, the pets. Even the birds get repossessed. Having always ached to fit in among the social elite, he decides to buy his way into high society. Outcast Oswald turns to crime with flair. Despite his integration of bird motifs and trick umbrellas, the Penguin is not pathologically obsessed with either. Unlike the Riddler, who must send riddles, or Two-Face, who becomes crippled with indecision when he can't toss his special coin, Oswald can function without his signature accoutrements. A museum curator putting a jeweled bird on display can count on Cobblepot to come steal it, of course. But passionate collecting does not necessarily equal utter obsession. In the Penguin's first appearance, the umbrella is his instrument of theft, hiding a rolled-up painting in its handle, and attack, firing bullets, acid, and strangling gas, thus making it part of his modus operandi. Unlike most other prominent bat foes, the Penguin, when incarcerated, goes to prison, not Arkham Asylum. Even by Gotham's ambiguous standards for criminal insanity, the Penguin is sane. For all his ruthlessness, the Penguin shows greater rationality than the Joker, more moments of sympathy than the Riddler, and a stronger need for superficial social acceptance than most of Batman's other foes.
The way you were being treated was beyond savage, and I simply couldn't stand for it. Not even caged animals should be treated that way.
Penguin to woman he saves from black market slavery. Joker's Asylum, The Penguin, number 1, 2008.
Careful, careful, whack, whack. Every one of them has a mother.
Penguin to Catwoman, sweeping up dehydrated pirates in Batman the Movie, 1966. This little man, who needs to be larger than life, fits what's informally and stereotypically known as a Napoleon complex, driven by his perceived social and physical handicaps to inflate himself in other areas of his life. With the stature of Napoleon and the nose of Cyrano de Bergerac, each of which range from slightly odd to freakishly unnatural, depending on who's drawing him at the time, Oswald overcompensates for feelings of inferiority by becoming self-centered, disdainful, and domineering toward others, a pattern that Alfred Adler called a superiority complex, as opposed to the inferiority complex, in which the person with poor self-esteem feels helpless, incapable of coping with life's demands, and unable to compensate for those inferior feelings. Physically different, maternally overprotected, and socially ostracized, Oswald Cobblepot hits the trifecta of what Adler considered the childhood sources for pathologically extreme feelings of inferiority. Organic inferiority, spoiling, and neglect. Adler saw the motivation to become better, striving for superiority, as he called it, as the fundamental fact of human life. We grow and move forward in life. The 8-year-old becomes more capable than he was at 7. One with healthy self-esteem feels good about that growth. Whereas one forming an inferiority complex fails to value his own achievements, and another who's constructing a superiority complex overvalues his strengths so he can try blinding himself to his shortcomings. Reality does not always let us ignore the things we dislike. Still sensitive to being mocked, the penguin might destroy someone's life or career over an insult, whether genuine or misinterpreted. And no matter how old the insult, because doing so makes him feel bigger. His hat adds height. So does his umbrella when it's up. Attired in monocle, tuxedo, and top hat, wearing no costume per se, the penguin dresses the same to rob a bank as he does to host a lavish party or run for mayor. Does he truly fancy himself to be a refined gentleman? Or is he a high society wannabe? In older stories, when he consistently looks fully human, albeit caricature-ish, it's harder to tell. In some post-Batman Returns comic book stories, not all but those in which he looks the most deformed, he thinks of the penguin, his darkest, most animal nature, as his true self, and Oswald Cobblepot as a pretense, a ruse, and in those instances, yes, the suit, the hat, everything about him that says, "Here's a gentleman," is all part of his Halloween costume. Many stories over the years have shown the penguin's attempts to go straight, or pretend to, after legal releases from prison. When he breaks out of prison, he's a gimmick criminal. But whenever he walks free, we get to watch his attempts to move upward in business, in the underworld, and in the social scene. From as early as the first story in which he ever appears, he has always wanted to be a crime boss. Mob bosses operate less effectively when they have to hide from the law. So do con artists. Aren't you people forgetting the facts? Batman cautions a parole board against releasing Cobblepot. The penguin is not only a master thief, he's a con man. Don't let him fool you. Sometimes the penguin lies about walking the straight and narrow. Sometimes he tries to keep his dealings legal. Tiring of incarceration, he seemingly goes legit and opens a trendy nightclub, the posh Iceberg Lounge, where he makes a bundle off overpriced merchandise, all the while hosting Gotham's criminals in the club's back rooms. For years, he walks a fine line, playing informant to costumed heroes often enough that they leave him right there, even while he works on building his underworld clout. Until, as with all such attempts, his insecurities make him go too far and hurt too many people, including one woman ready to love him, and he returns to prison in the end. "A perfect crime is a work of art, a thing of beauty, and a joy forever," to paraphrase the Bard. Penguin, Detective Comics number 611, February 1990. Case File 7-3, Poison Ivy. Real name, Pamela Lillian Isley. Doctor in some versions. First appearance, Batman number 181, June 1966. Origin. A botany biochemistry student writing her thesis on plant-animal hybridization, shy, timid Pamela Isley, gets seduced and betrayed by a man who poisons her, altering her biochemistry in a way that renders her body immune to all toxins, her kiss toxic to others, and her mood subject to violent swings. Unable to bear children, she experiments with creating plant-based life forms she calls her children. Robbing and killing to fund her research, she becomes an eco-terrorist, an environmentally motivated terrorist dedicated to preserving plant life at all costs. She creates pheromonal scents that make others, especially men, susceptible to her influence. Over time, she becomes more plant-like herself. Her skin turns green. She develops an empathetic link with plants, and then the florokinetic ability to control them through sheer will. And poison ivy evolves into a formidable foe. The greener she grows, the less human she becomes. Despite some attraction to Batman and others, more apparent earlier in her criminal career, Ivy grows detached from humanity and less interested in people over time. Her best and sometimes only friend is the Joker's moll, Harley Quinn, whose friendship helps ground Ivy not only by reconnecting Ivy to the human race, but because Ivy tends to think more sensibly when faced with Harley's irrationality. Unlike fellow eco-terrorist Ra's al Ghul, who wants to reduce the human population and would destroy all civilization if he thought it necessary to keep people from destroying the planet, Ivy's ecological efforts concentrate on preserving and promoting plant life. More positive than Ra's, albeit twistedly so, since she'll kill individual guards who might keep her from stealing what she needs, and she periodically hunts down corporate bigwigs whose companies have destroyed forests and her floral children. A plant-human hybrid with chlorophyll in her blood. She has no interest in destroying humankind, nor in saving it, but she still knows she's more than a vegetable. I can't deny I'm a creation of both the plant and human worlds. I can't stay in one too long before I begin to miss the other. When she feels both sides of her nature in balance, she takes a biocentrist, life-centered perspective, an ethical viewpoint extending value to all species, ecosystems, and natural processes, regardless of sentience. During her biocentrist spells, she helps feed fruit to the homeless and underprivileged instead of feeding people to her plants. Not that these periods last. Her empathy for plant life, a kind of psychic link to vegetation, intrudes on her already limited ability to feel for non-plant life. A child of wealthy but distant parents, she never learns how to get close to others. Receiving no empathy growing up, she never develops any of her own. The fascination she feels for plants while growing up may come about in compensation. Loving plants is safe because they will not reject, chide, or abandon her. Empathy, the capacity to recognize and share others' feelings, eludes her until mutagenic changes force her to feel what the plants around her experience. Just plants, not people. Still not attuned to other people's feelings and never having learned outgoing social skills, she relishes her biochemical power over others instead. When she ponders why she doesn't move into a jungle and stay, she considers, "Perhaps it's the power I exert over others that keeps driving me back. I like a challenge, and I can't rest when I feel I haven't won." The comic books keep referring to her power over other people as pheromonal. But is it really? A pheromone is a social scent, a chemical that triggers a natural behavioral response by members of the same species. Our bodies detect pheromones through our sense of smell, affecting us through our olfactory system, even if we don't consciously realize it at the time. Sex pheromones attract mates, typically the female of the species emitting pheromones that indicate her sexual receptivity, as opposed to releaser pheromones, which can attract mates from miles away without eliciting a direct sexual response. While Ivy has greater power over men, she can influence women as well, like when she makes Catwoman deliver a case of money to her. Organisms can release some types of pheromones that will affect members of the same sex, like aggregation pheromones, which will bring members of the same species together regardless of gender. If she gave more thought to the range of people's feelings, Ivy might try using alarm pheromones to trigger fight-or-flight responses, thereby making people turn violent or fearful. To the extent that Ivy's influence is plant-based, the power is not pheromonal, because humans and plants are different species. Botanical biochemist that she is,